Ничего
не пишите.
Пишите.
Ничего не читайте. Не
читайте.
Ничего не говорите. Говорите.
Ничего не печатайте.
It's the worst possible combination of events, but it's a prime example of bad planning.
Yeah, it definitely is going to take a bit of better planning and further investment going forward. It seems to be probably the product of having upgraded and added capacity for some of the newer broadband, mobile broadband services and devices that people are, you know, expecting to be able to use anywhere. Expanding that to have a wider footprint is one thing, but to have it connected in ways that work in the event of something like this is a little bit a step further than just deploying new systems, if you know what I mean. So it may have the capability to run in different modes and connect, as we described, tower to tower or using schemes that balance the load. But certainly in an emergency, you wouldn't want to prioritize stuff that takes up precious little whatever data there is, and especially if local municipalities are relying on dedicated services or other lines that need power and to be up for responding to it. So, I mean, the scheme itself, it may be fragile in its current state, but it certainly, like you said, with planning could be improved upon. And if it's, a newer type of cellular service, that stuff is probably built in. It's probably a feature that just has yet to be realized in production.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, part of what I was surprised about, I didn't tell this part of the story earlier, was that if there's a tendency for production services that you think would know better to rely on the commodity internet. And this was really surprising to me. And I don't think there's a lot of excuse here. So two related stories. One is gas stations. So the power's out and some gas stations have generators. The power came back on, you know, central and closer to the cities, you know, earlier, like it always does than the surrounding areas. And some gas stations were able to open. Now I saw lines of 30 to 50 cars with sheriffs, you know, directing traffic and stuff like that. And so what I learned pretty quickly was that, first of all, there was some, I think, voluntary rationing. So some gas stations were limiting to $20 worth of gas or 20 gallons, and some were cash only. What then became evident was that some of these gas stations were able to take payment cards, you know, credit cards, debit cards, because they weren't using the commodity internet. They were using probably a KU band satellite dish on the top of their station. So stations that had chosen to maintain that redundant technology, or maybe were in the first place using that satellite technology rather than only relying on the internet, were able to have business open, you know, and to keep things going. And that's pretty important when you have not only gas stations, but also, supermarkets, hospitals, all that sort of thing.
One thing we've been talking about, I think, throughout the discussion tonight is batteries. And I'm curious what thoughts you might have about the role they could play, especially with the emphasis on things like solar and more distributed alternate power sources. If you were able to modify and allowed to increase the battery size on something that allowed communications, or if people were running a business like that, but increasing their options as far as powering when there is no power. Because mm-hmm. that seems to be the recurring theme, is that everything is relying on that, whether it's data as running on the assumption of there being power when there isn't, if people have things they can switch to or use as a resource in a bind like this, they can then start building other things that they're going to need, priorities and the like, into that availability of some kind of power. And I think I feel if more people are able to do it themselves, I mean, what do you guys think about that?
Well, scaling up backup power can be pretty expensive. And so having the ability to have batteries that get you through a blip in the power or maybe a few hour outage is one thing. Having battery backup to get you through a multi-day outage is another thing. And more likely what we'd see, and I did see quite a lot of this in the community I was in, is a system where you have batteries and backup generators. And so the batteries cover the blip and maybe an hour, maybe a couple of hours, but the backup generators come on and they keep you going. So that's probably able to sustain. We had a neighbor with a propane generator. He had 10 days worth of propane and he got a delivery top up after 2 or 3 days. So he's good to go for quite a while. And hospitals, I think, are in the same type of situation. So I know there's another comment, and then I want to talk about airports a little bit too.
Okay, we only have about 4 minutes, so we're going to have to make it quick. But I just wanted to ask you quickly, you're using Starlink right now from UConn. Was anyone using Starlink in that area?
I didn't see evidence of Starlink dishes, and I was kind of surprised that wasn't more common. And I think it might just be a basic economic decision in that if you have DSL and you're paying, maybe $50 or $100 a month, then maybe going the extra cost of Starlink, even if it's not that much more, might not be that appealing. I bet a lot of people are going to be calling up Starlink over the next week or two, though, as a backup.
All right. Well, quickly tell you your airport story.
Yeah. So this was, again, a very, very, very big surprise to me. So the Asheville airport was the airport I was scheduled to fly out of and scheduled to fly out on Sunday. And the regional news as of Saturday night and Sunday early was saying, yeah, the airport's open. They have power, but they don't have network and they don't know if they'll be able to get planes out. And the TV screens were all off in the airport, things like that. So I went to the airport and subsequently ended up flying out from Charlotte on Monday. We went to an airport 150 miles to the east where they were more up to capacity. So the surprise was that the airlines in Asheville Airport were using the commodity internet for their critical operations. They had no backup system. They didn't have radios. They didn't have satellite dishes. They didn't have, for example, airplanes that could carry messages back and forth or get alternate communications equipment into place. And I think the airport operations were more resilient. The air traffic control seemed to be able to function in some way. I don't know what all their backup mechanisms are, but the airlines themselves were just dead in the water. They couldn't board people. They couldn't check boarding passes. They couldn't issue tickets. They couldn't change seats. None of the regular stuff that they do. Wow. And when I was there on Sunday morning, the security gate was closed. Like they were so far away from being able to put people on planes and get planes in and out that that people were not even working. When I got there on Monday morning, the security gate was open. There were personnel from one of the several airlines that operate out of that small airport there, and the other airlines weren't even present. I think they showed up later in the day. So the reliance of an airport on commodity internet for their basic operations was a surprise, and I really felt it was something that if I was in an airline doing a continuity of operations plan for that airline, I would certainly not be relying on the commodity internet for critical communications.
Absolutely not. Wow. A lot of lessons to be learned from here, lessons that I think they should have already learned, but I hope it all gets cataloged and detailed because there's so much to draw upon. In closing, these are things that people should always have available to them. Obviously, cash in case the ATMs or credit card system stop working, paper copies of important documents, like the deed to your house, maybe in case it gets challenged somehow, landline, I feel like, I'm a dog with a bone here, but having a landline is at least a possibility that you might still be connected. Even if it gets completely torn down with everything else, it's still going to last longer than a cell phone network that goes out. And of course, BAI listeners, a radio, because yeah, you might be able to stream things from all over the world, but when you lose electricity and connectivity, you can't. When you have a radio, you turn it on. If there's a battery, you're going to get a signal. And you'll be able to do it anonymously. And it's, I've been listening to radio from North Carolina the last few days, and it's been so eye-opening and so revealing how important radio is. And with that, you know, I'd like to encourage people to support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org, because we are your community radio station here in New York City. And when something hits the fan, you know we're going to be there to tell you all about it and to give you advice and help. Greg, thank you so much for sharing this. I'm so happy you're safe back in UConn. And please, no more daredevil adventures into the wrath of nature.
Indeed. Yeah. Thanks for a great discussion about this stuff. The aftermath continues. I think there will be lessons learned. I think the odds of accountability increasing and people getting smart about preparedness, unfortunately, the odds are against that happening. But certainly there are a lot of lessons learned.
OTH@2600.com is our email address. We will see you here next week on WBAI. Have a good night.
Brought us from the bottom of hell. Cause the black is back and it's bound to sell. Picture us cooling out on the 4th of July. And if you heard we were celebrating, that's a worldwide lie. Yo, Chuck, the fat generals, man, trying to pull a 226 on your G. Yo, man, show them what you got. Show them what you got.
This style seems wild. Wait before you treat me like a stepchild. Let me tell you why they got me all foul. Cause I give you what you lack. Come right in next back. Our status is the status, so I care where you at. Black in at home, I got a call from Tony Rome. The FBI was tapping my telephone. I never live alone, I never walk alone. My posse's always ready and they're waiting in my zone. Although I live the life that I'm a resident, but I've been knowing the scheme that I'm the president. Tapping my phone, who screws abuse? I stand accused of doing harm. A rock hard trooper to the bone, a bone, a bone. Full grown, consider me stone. Once again, and I say it for you to know. The troop is always ready. I am Geronimo, your CIA. You see, I ain't kidding. Both T and X, they got rid of both. A story untold, true but unknown. Professor Griff knows.
Yo, I ain't no toast.
And not the bragging, I'm boasting. And plus, it ain't no secret why the tap on my phone. As though I can't keep it a secret, so I decided to kick it, yo. And yes, it weighs a ton, I say it once again. I'll never be a friend of those with closed minds and know that I'm rapid. The way that I rap it is making them tap it, yeah. Never serving a well, cause I'm an uncom. It's no secret at all. Selling that power, building the nation, so joining the set, the point blank target. Every brother's inside, so least nothing to get, no. Taking a flame is not a waste. Here takes a bit of a soul, so you can never be wrong. Just a bit of advice, cause we be paying a price. Cause every brother man's life is like swinging a dice, right? Here it is once again. This says the brother, the terminator, the cutter. Going on, and leave alone the grown. Get it straight in 88, and I'm trooping to demonstrate. The posse always ready, 98 and 98. My posse goes quick. Cause my posse got velocity, tapping my phone. Never leave me alone, I'm even lethal when I'm unarmed.
Hej og velkommen til det næste afsnit af podcastserien Musik i Hjernen. En serie på 8 afsnit i alt, hvor vi tager dig med på en slags opdagelsesrejse i lyd gennem din hjerne. Og jeg kan anbefale dig at lytte til det her med et godt sæt hørtelefoner på, fordi vi har virkelig kælet for lyden i det her program. Så hvis du er klar, så kan vi begynde.
All right, then I'll put you in.
Here we go.
We'll leave, and then we talk again.
I dette afsnit skal vi dybt ned i hjernen. Det, du kan høre i baggrunden, er lyden af mig, som er på vej ind i en kæmpestor MR-scanner for at få scannet min hjerne. Det foregår på Center for Music in the Brain ved Aarhus Universitet, hvor jeg har været igennem en række forsøg, men det her viste sig at være lidt for meget.
I think I'll give you some padding under the arms. It's a bit more comfortable. Lift your arm here.
Could you take me out again for a moment, please?
Det viste sig, at jeg har lidt klaustrofobi, og lige pludselig, med mit hoved sat fast i en hjerneskanner,
sorry,
fik jeg lidt panikangst.
It's extreme. I'm getting a little anxiety. I'm sorry.
Og det er lige præcis den slags ting, vi skal høre om i det her afsnit.
I'll leave you there for a second. Or do you want to come down?
I would like to come down, if that's okay.
Om de følelser, som man slet ikke kan styre. Om frygt, angst, men også glæde og ekstase. Følelser, som vi alle sammen, mere eller mindre, kan få adgang til gennem musik. Og her er vores guide gennem hele den her serie, jazzmusiker og professor i neurovidenskab og leder for Center for Music in the Brain, Peter Wust.
Det følelsesmæssige forhold, som mennesker har til musik, det er nok det væsentligste forhold, vi har. Du spørger almindelige mennesker, som man siger, så vil de altid sige, jamen vi lytter til musik, fordi vi får den og den følelse af det, eller vi bliver glade, eller vi bruger det, når vi er kede af det, osv. Og det er jo noget, som kan være meget svært at undersøge i hjernen. Det er typisk nogle områder i hjernen, som ligger meget dybt nede. De her emotionelle områder i hjernen, eller centre, eller kerner i hjernen, som jo ligger i det, der hedder det limbiske system. Vi er jo ret langt fremme med at forstå, hvad det er, der gør os en lille smule høje af musik. Altså den der nydelse, vi får af musik. Der har vi alle de her forsøg, der viser noget om dopaminsystemet, belønningssystemet osv. Og vi har også gode undersøgelser af, hvordan det her belønningssystem det også reagerer i forhold til for eksempel forventningsstrukturer i musik. Altså når man bryder forventninger i musik, kan det så gøre os en lille smule høje. Det har vi en ret god forståelse af. Der hvor vi mangler en masse forståelse, det er af de mere specifikke følelser. Sorg og glæde, og det har vi og andre lavet forsøg med. Men der hvor vi mangler en stor viden, det er ved at forstå, jamen de her, der er nogle unikke følelser ved musik. Noget hvor man lytter til et stykke musik, og man tænker, det her giver mig en helt bestemt følelse. Jeg kan ikke forklare hvad det er, men det er bare unikt for musik.
Hvad føler du lige nu? Er du glad? Er du vred? Er du trist måske? Eller nostalgisk? Eller er du bare ligeglad?
Altså man kan jo ikke måle følelser direkte i hjernen på den måde forstået, at man kan se om folk er glade eller triste eller sure eller bange. Det er jo noget, man er nødt til at have adfærdsforsøg til. Og der er man nødt til enten at spørge folk, hvad føler du lige nu? Og så er vi jo allerede et skridt væk fra den følelse, vi for eksempel kan få gennem musikken. Der er jo mange af de her æstetiske oplevelser, som kan være svære. Vi har næsten ikke engang et sprog for det. Så man skal både have udviklet et sprog, man skal også forsøge at forstå fænomenet ved at lave adfærdsforsøg, og så skal man så bagefter lave hjerneskanningerne.
Det her afsnit kommer til at handle meget om lige præcis det her. Om et manglende sprog. Om hvordan det er næsten umuligt at beskrive, hvordan det føles at blive påvirket af musik.
Ja.
Nu skal vi høre fra en forsker, som har lavet et ret ambitiøst forsøg på at stille spørgsmålet. Hvordan føles musik? Her er Professor Thomas Fritz.
My name is Tom Fritz. I'm from the Max Planck Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig, and I am the leader of the research group Music Evoked Brain Plasticity.
Thomas Fritz fik den idé at finde folk, som aldrig har hørt musik. I hvert fald ikke, hvad du og jeg vil kalde musik. Han vil gerne finde ud af, om det med følelser og musik kommer indenfra vores hjerne, noget vi er født med, noget vi alle sammen gør helt automatisk, eller om følelser er noget, som vi lærer gennem vores opvækst og omgivelser. Thomas hørte om en gruppe af mennesker, som boede i Centralafrika, som han meget gerne vil mødes med.
The Mafa in Cameroon?
Det var kun et problem for Thomas. Mafa-folket boede ret langt væk fra de sikre omgivelser af The Max Planck Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences.
It's a little bit dangerous, really. The whole region was really quite dangerous at that time, too, because it's a region where you have a lot of Boko Haram, and, you know, it's really just generally a little bit dangerous. But I chose the place because we were looking for a very traditional type of participant who would not go to churches and would not have neighbors with a radio or so. So these were quite strict criteria. They had no electricity then. They had a very conservative lifestyle for hundreds, maybe thousands of years there. Their musical tradition is very different.
Der er en ret stor forskel mellem, hvad du og jeg vil kalde musik, og hvad Mafa-folket kalder det. Faktisk har Mafa-folket engang et ord for musik som sådan. Det er ikke sådan, at Mafa-folket ikke har musik. De har bare en meget anderledes opfattelse af, hvad musik er.
So, when I was there, I was quite lucky that it was the time of the year when you play the flutes. And these flutes were actually quite inspiring for me. I have a set of flutes. I can get them if you want to. Yeah, and you can hear one too. So, yeah, this is the largest flute. And all of these different flutes, they only play one tone. And this is the smallest one. It's quite challenging to play this. Music making is something that I believe that's actually something universal that brings people together. You know, I think that the music making together and sharing this physical experience together. So I participated in this music flute playing rituals, or I tried to. You know, I think people were quite tolerant with me and appreciated that I gave it a try. And it was very exhausting. People play for a very long time, so for many hours. And this has to be played in a very specific rhythm. And the higher they go, so it's very exhausting, and people get in a trance-like state. They were having very euphoric experiences, going into extreme happiness, and then also totally forgetting about themselves and just, you know, only engaged in performing the music. For them, it's a way to very systematically get high without having to drink beer or so.
Nu var det tid for Thomas at komme i gang med hans eksperimenter. Mafa-folket har sandsynligvis aldrig hørt optaget eller forstærket musik. Og det var derfor, at Thomas har valgt lige præcis dem til sine eksperimenter.
The first few weeks, I really didn't know if my experiments were going to be a success or a total disaster. I mean, if you have headphones on for the first time in your life, it's a very surprising experience, yeah? And they were, of course, looking behind them if there's someone there, etc. And some people listening to this, they would go, wow, I've never listened to anything like that before, but I really like it. And others, they said, whoa, I've never listened to anything like that before, but I hate it. So that was quite surprising, you know.
And again, see, Mafa-folket havde de samme følelsesmæssige associationer til musik, som han havde. Og som dig og mig har. Thomas' musikalsk følelsestest var i virkeligheden ret simpel.
So I had a whole range of different experiments that I performed with the Marfa. It was really a battery. I had a collection, for example, of music recordings of very different styles from the past few centuries, really. It was even selected for being, you know, as different as possible. Tango, Irish folk music, rock and roll music, for example, brass music, all instrumental music. So that was the constraint. So these happy, sad, scary, I did with a set of very simplistic piano music to test musical emotion. Dim, diddly, 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 dim, dim, dim. You know, very like playful and sad or scary music, like a very, you know, like you'd imagine from a horror movie or so. You know, like this stuff. So they were listening to these short piano pieces while looking at three different faces that were actually printed out in original face size, depicting either a smiling or a sad or a scared face. In their music, they don't have these emotional expressions in music. They don't have this happiness, sadness or so in music. For them, that's absolutely, you know, that's preposterous. They think that, why would you do that? But still, if you play these musical sounds, they would point to a face that would be either happy or a sad face. So this is something that obviously seems to work at the very basic levels, that even if you've never listened to a music like that, you'd say, huh, that sad face fits better to this music. They were actually surprisingly good at identifying these emotional expressions and relating them to the different facial expressions. And this was even with the constraint that the facial expressions that we had available, we used a library of these facial expressions from the 70s, which was a collection of white faces. So like, and you know, so even faces that people were not even familiar with, and still they would point to then the happy, sad, or, you know, fearful face. How the music actually transports its information is much more universal than we, you know, we tend to think. I think to some degree our capability to differentiate emotional expressions from certain music is hardwired.
Kan det være, at vores følelser og dermed vores hjerner er hardwired til musik, som Thomas mener?
I think music can do so much more, so I try to refrain from only discussing this in terms of basic emotions. Music can trigger several basic emotions at the same time, you know. Music can be so complex and manage to activate representations of very complex emotions.
Og gider du tænde over på væggen der til venstre for døren?
Lyder det rigtigt? Eller den her, den store knap? Den lille knap er tændt.
Den er tændt.
30-års Julia Bang har været ud for at lave en reportage. Hun vil gerne snakke med en, som har en meget speciel tilgang til musik. Det er ham her. Og han hedder Willy E. Moser.
Nu kommer han. Ja, det kan du sagtens sige. Der er lys i.
Willy E. Moser er ikke vokset op i en fjern kultur langt fra vores som Maffa-folket, men alligevel er hans oplevelse af musik meget interessant for os. Fordi Willy E. Moser har aldrig haft mulighed for at se nogen spille musik, eller se på andres ansigter, når de reagerer på musik. Og det er det en meget god grund til.
Jeg er født i 1944 og har været blind fra fødslen. Og da jeg var 15 år, 58, der boede jeg på det, der dengang hed Statens Institut for Blinde og Svagsynede. Der havde vi den formidable sum af 80 kroner om måneden i lommepenge. Der tjente jeg til en pladespiller, som var min.
Den 15-årige Willy E. Moser brugte sin opsparede lommepenge på en pladespiller, et sæt hørtelefoner og en lille stak LP-plader.
Der var ingen højtalere i den. Man forbandt pick-upens ledninger til en hovedtelefon.
Og det var en af disse plader, som snart skulle påvirke Willy på en helt ekstrem måde.
Det var en søndag morgen. Klokken var 5:30. Vi lå på sovesalen. Jeg lå i sengen og kunne ikke rigtig sove mere. Men så havde jeg fået de plader lagt fra, sådan at de var til at få fat i. Det var 12 forskellige plader. Og jeg vidste godt, at Stravinsky, Le Sacre du Printemps, lå bagest. Jeg har bare aldrig hørt musikken før.
Willy var lige på nippet at finde ud af, lige præcis hvor godt hans hjerne var hardwired til musik.
Så kunne jeg høre det. De første toner. Da, di, 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 da. Et stykke inde i musikken kommer der en passage, hvor det virkelig er grumt, vind og skæve disharmonier, som vræler oven i hinanden. Dissonans oven på dissonans oven på dissonans. Det var et så overvældende indtryk, så jeg havde ikke nogen våben imod det. Det var som et lynnedslag. Kan du forberede dig på et lynnedslag? Nej. Det blev hele tiden ved med at være værre end værst. Le Sacre du Printemps, det betyder jo forårsoffringer. Og det handlede jo om, at landsbyens smukkeste pige skulle danse sig til døde. Som et offer til guderne.
Og du kunne mærke et eller andet?
Jeg kunne mærke, da hun døde. I brystet. Hvis du kalder det et eller andet. Altså, selvfølgelig stod mit hjerte ikke stille. Det gør et hjerte ikke sådan bare af sig selv. Men jeg oplevede det, som om det stod stille. Der var ikke... Jeg kunne ikke huske, at jeg trak vejret. Jeg mærkede ikke mig selv. Det var nok noget i retning af det, der engang hed en ud-af-kroppen-oplevelse. Jeg havde det, som om at jeg svævede over et sted, hvor musikken blev spillet fra.
Det findes mange urban legends om, hvad der skete i Paris i 1913, da Stravinskys værk fik sin premiere. Det var første gang, at nogen som helst havde oplevet den slags moderne musik, og historierne siger, at det ikke gik stille for sig. Musikken var så underlig, så provokerende og så effektfuld, at det siges, at publikummet begyndte at komme op og slås med hinanden, at de kastede rundt med stoler og alt muligt, at de buede og hissede og opførte sig helt aggressivt. Og rigtig mange af dem stormede ud af koncertsalen i frygt og vrede. Og det var lige præcis det stykke musik, som Willy E. Moser lå i sin seng og hørte på pladespilleren. Og det var en oplevelse, han aldrig kommer til at glemme.
Jeg ved ikke, om jeg kommer for langt ud, men jeg kan sammenligne med, hvis du sidder i et tog, og du finder ud af, at du kører nedad. Og du får at vide, at desværre er bremserne gået i stykker. Og du ved ikke, hvor langt du skal køre. Eller hvor hurtigt du kører. Du kan bare høre, farten den bliver hurtigere og hurtigere og hurtigere. Og du aner ikke, hvor det ender. Og så kommer du ind i en tunnel, hvor du så ikke kan se ud af vinduet. Kan det blive værre, det her? Kan det overhovedet blive værre? Det var som at falde i en afgrund. Bundløs afgrund. Og hvor jeg blev ved med at falde i alle tre kvarterer. Jeg tror, at de mennesker, som hørte den første gang i 1913 i Paris, De løb deres vej af skræk. De blev bange for, at det var Guds mening, at noget levende menneske kunne komponere sådan. Det kunne jeg godt selv have gjort, hvis jeg havde haft mulighed for det.
Så hvad skete i hjernen på Willy E. Moser? Hvordan kunne musikken vække så stærk en reaktion i ham? Nu er det tid til at møde en ekspert, som måske kan hjælpe os med at forklare det.
Right. Do you want a long introduction or a short one? My name is David Huron, and I'm an Academy Professor Emeritus from The Ohio State University. My career has really been oriented towards trying to understand what emotions are evoked when people listen to music.
Det her er David Huron, og han har brugt en lang karriere på at kigge på, hvad musik gør ved vores følelser.
I think we've identified maybe 2 dozen types or class of experiences, different ways that you can tickle the limbic system through the medium of sound.
Hvorfor kan vi lide musik, der vækker negative følelser? Tristhed, for eksempel. Hvorfor elsker vi sad songs?
I've been interested for some time in music and sadness, in particular the question, why would anyone listen to music that makes them feel sad? And so for the last 30-odd years in my laboratory, we've done quite a bit of work on sad music.
Prøv at lytte til det her nummer. Det hedder Gloomy Sunday. Den var oprindeligt indspillet i 1933 på ungarsk af Rizzo Ceres. Prøv at lægge mærke til, om det føles trist for dig.
There are lots of different forms of sadness. Some of them have names and some of them don't have names yet. Melancholy, grief, which is characterized by weeping, and nostalgia. One of the difficulties of studying emotions in music is trying to have something that you can observe. When you look at somebody who's listening to music, they might be just sitting in a chair quietly, and they might be in a state of bliss, or they might be completely bored out of their skull, and they look exactly the same way. So when we do research, we're always looking for some information, something that we can observe, things like when the music brings tears to a person's eyes, or when they stop breathing momentarily, or we've had cameras where we put them, aim them at a person's forearm. So we can see the hair follicles actually puckering up and the hair standing up in the back of their neck or along their forearm. Those are things we can observe. We might weep, watery eyes, and this weird sort of breathing that this kind of panting breathing going on, or in the case of really truly terrifying circumstances, we might simply freeze. And breath holding is one of those features of this freeze response. That's when the music takes your breath away.
Sang Gloomy Sunday er også kendt som den ungarsk selvmords sang, og den er også kilde til rigtig mange vandrehistorier. Det siges, at den var forbundet med en epidemi af selvmord i 1930'erne. At folk blev så triste, da de hørte den, at de simpelthen valgte at tage deres eget liv. Måske var der noget særligt i den konstruktion af akkorder og tonarter, og den triste melodi sammen med hans lyrik, der simpelthen var for trist. Men David Huron har regnet på mange andre elementer i musikken, som har direkte effekter på vores følelser.
We have these experiences without thinking about them. They just spontaneously happen. There are whole classes of sounds that we can point to that are fear-inducing. The first one is loudness. So loud sounds are more likely to induce fear than quiet sounds. And for the very good reason that loud sounds usually indicate that there's a lot of energy in the environment. There's a giant boulder rolling down the slope towards me. I probably should pay attention to that. Another is low pitch. This is universal throughout the animal kingdom, from frogs to elephants. And throughout the animal kingdom, low pitch is associated with aggression or seriousness, and high pitch is associated with deference or submission. It's universal. You can also see that in music. These are sounds that are so low that you can't actually hear them. You can only feel them. Those will also cause a feeling of fear. You can feel them instead. There's a wonderful experiment that was done in Britain where they put a large pipe in a basement of a church where they had a concert, and it produced a pitch or a frequency of 17 hertz, which is below audibility. You can't hear it. Sometimes they had that pipe turned on, and sometimes it wasn't turned on. And they were able to induce experiences of chills or shivers in audience members when they had the pipe turned on, as to when they didn't have the pipe turned on.
Hvis du prøver høretelefoner, hører du aldrig de meget, meget dybe toner. Men hvis du har været til koncert, eller hørt en DJ-set, eller til en festival, eller faktisk bare været ude på gaden, så kan du alligevel mærke de der frekvenser, selvom du ikke kan høre dem. Og de påvirker din hjerne.
So another is what used to be called volume, what we call extensity, the size of the sound. This big sound, the sound that has multiple sound sources, this kind of surrounding feeling of a lot of activity going on. That's exactly the reason why an amygdala should say this might be indicative of something I should be afraid of. I'm surrounded here. Or another way of thinking about it is that the sound environment is being very complicated. It's complex. And that's challenging for the brain. How do I keep track of all these sound sources? And that now becomes a feeling of potential threat. So there are sounds that will inherently be fearful. What we know about the brain, it's essentially two aspects to the brain. One is the part that we're aware of, the conscious part, what we think of as us. And then Freud was wrong about a lot of things, but he was right about the notion of the unconscious, that there are things that we experience that are not accessible to our conscious mind. Many cases we experience fear very momentarily. Those fears are unconscious and low level, not accessible to conscious thought, and are often very fleeting and very fast. What we know is that the fear is associated with many things in the brain, but one particular area called the amygdala. And the amygdala can be activated very, very quickly. We need to respond to fearful situations very, very quickly if we want to survive. And we know that we're fastest at responding to sounds. And this low-level response will be very quick. From the ear, you go virtually directly into the amygdala. At the same time, there's a second pathway that goes up through the cortex, through the thinking part of the brain, that we're aware of. There's a part of you that's afraid of the situation, but at the same time, consciously you know that you're safe, you're not endangered here. But what we know from the research is that a way to feel even better is to feel bad and then to feel good. And similarly, feeling bad is not very nice, but we can make you feel even worse by making you feel good and then making you feel bad. So feelings are very susceptible to contrast. And so one of the things that's happening in music is that musicians play with some elements of things that are, quote, bad, like fear, as a way of producing this contrast that the pleasurable part then is even more pleasurable. Feeling good is good. But what we know from the research is that when we talk about sublime emotions, a way to feel even better is to feel bad and then to feel good. There's an old joke, why do you keep beating your head against the wall? To which the answer is, because it feels so good when I stop.
Nu er det tid til den sidste gæst i dette afsnit. Vi skal til en helt praktisk undersøgelse af noget, som du sikkert har gjort utallige gange. Du har set film, måske i biografen, med stor lyd på og en masse musik, og du har grinet, og du har grædt. Dine følelser er blevet påvirket af filmens brug af musik og lyd. Jeg snakker med den danske filmlydguru Peter Albrechtsen, om han ikke vil forklare, hvordan disse teknikker bruges i praksis, når man mixer lyd til en film, som han gør.
At lave musik til en film er virkelig på en eller anden måde altid lidt en udfordring. For hvordan skal musikken lyde? Hvad skal musikken fortælle er næsten endnu vigtigere. Og også, hvor meget musik skal der være? Jeg synes ofte, man oplever i mange store Hollywood-film, at der er utrolig meget musik, som hele tiden prøver at fortælle os, hvad vi skal føle. Og musikken bliver så påduttende med følelser, at jeg ender med ikke rigtig at føle noget, fordi det bare bliver sådan et konstant sådan et baggrundslyd. Den her violin kommer ind med sin følsomme. Inden jeg faktisk er blevet ked af det. I stedet for, at den venter på, at jeg begynder at mærke det inde i mig, og så kommer violinen. Og det er sådan et eksempel på, hvordan placering af musik i en film er en meget, meget væsentlig del af musikken. Fordi det handler om, at man med musikken forstærker følelserne i publikum. Nogle gange har man brug for at lave en uhyggelig film, en gyserfilm, hvor musikken skal skabe en ubehag og en uro og en angst og en sådan helt skræmmende kvalitet, som jo kommer ofte af, at man bruger atonale klange, man bruger meget voldsom dynamik med pludselig høj musik, eller man bruger instrumenter, der bliver spillet på en måde, som får dem til at lyde ubehageligt, eller man spiller på violinen med buen vendt om, så det lyder. Man bliver bange, man får et ubehag, man får en uro. Det stik modsat kunne være en komedie, hvor man skaber en lethed, som ligesom kan give os den her følelse af glæde og en følelse af, at selvom man måske ser på en scene, som med noget sørgmodig musik på havde virket sørgmodig, så fordi musikken i sit udtryk er let og behageligt, lidt sjovt. Og musikken påvirker os underbevidst. En af sådan de store guruer inden for filmlyd, Walter Murch, sagde de kloge ord, som jeg ofte citerer, at billedet banker på fordøren, og lyden sniger sig ind ad bagdøren. Og lyden sniger sig ind der sammen med musikken. Det skal forstås på den måde, at lyden og musikken påvirker vores underbevidsthed, hvorimod det visuelle taler til vores bevidsthed. Vi er meget bevidste om billeder. Jeg prøver i virkeligheden at tænke på lyden som musik, så jeg tænker i rytmer, jeg tænker i toner, jeg tænker om hvilke den her mørke klang, der ligger inde i den her hus. Det er jo næsten en musikalsk lyd i sig selv. Og så er der måske et ur, der tikker. Så kommer der et stykke musik ind. Hvis det ur, jeg har lagt på, passer ind i rytmen i musikken, så får du en følelse af, at musikken vokser ud af filmen. Den her følelse af, at langsomt så er der noget meget dæmonisk, der sniger sig ind på dig, og lige pludselig er du bare omgivet af de her uhyggelige klange og uhyggelige lyde, som giver dig den her indre uro. Det kan også være, at tonerne er en lille smule skæve i forhold til hinanden, og så opstår der en disharmoni. En af de mest klassiske eksempler på det er lyssværene i Star Wars-filmene, hvor Luke Skywalker og de andre gode har et lyssvær, som når de tænder det, så er det i dur. Men Darth Vader, han har et lyssvær, der er i mol. Så snart de to skal til at slås med deres lyssvær, og det ene lyssvær møder det andet lyssvær, så opstår der en disharmoni. Og det gør jo, at man får den her følelse af, uha, nu sker der altså noget farligt noget. Jeg synes jo selv, det er ret fascinerende, det her med, hvordan arbejder vores hjerne? Altså, hvordan bliver den påvirket af ting? Og hvad er det, der gør, at vi bliver påvirket af nogle ting frem for andre ting? lyd er helt utroligt subjektivt. Hvad betyder en lyd for dig? Hvis den her lyd betyder det her for dig, hvad betyder den så for mig? Der er så meget i vores fortolkning af lyd, som er næsten umuligt at sætte ord på, og hvor man på en eller anden måde bliver nødt til, synes jeg, at have en eller anden form for sådan en, et åndeligt fællesskab, der rækker hinsides ordene. Og det synes jeg er helt vildt fascinerende. Det er et område, der, hvor man hele tiden kan gøre nye opdagelser. Lyd i sig selv som stof er fuldstændig elastisk og så følelsesmæssigt stærkt. Når det rammer allerstærkest, så er det den vildeste medicin, det vildeste drug, det vildeste følelsesmæssige rush. Vi har så få ord om det, og noget af det, jeg sætter meget pris på ved, at der er så meget forskning, det er også, at der bliver, man arbejder med på at skabe et vokabularium om noget, som er så svært at tale om, og som jeg tror, alle, der arbejder med lyd, har oplevet, hvor svært det er at fortælle om det, vi laver. Så en ting er, at forskningen ligesom kan fortælle os noget om, hvad der sker inde i vores hoveder og i vores kroppe, når vi oplever lyd. En anden ting er, at det kan skabe et sprog om lyd, som ellers er den mest usynlige del af vores verden.
Vi har en god forståelse af, hvad der sker, når vi nyder noget, og vi har en god forståelse af, hvad der for eksempel sker, når noget groover, når vi får lyst til at bevæge os til musik. Og man tænker, det her giver mig en helt bestemt følelse. Jeg kan ikke forklare, hvad det er, men det er bare unikt for musik. Det er det der med at forstå, hvad det egentlig er, der sker, når vi føler, at noget groover, når vi får lyst til at danse til noget musik.
Det med musik og lysten til at bevæge os, lysten til at danse eller bare knipse med fingrene, det må vente til et andet afsnit, fordi nu skal vi videre. Videre på vores opdagelsesrejse gennem hjernens mange musikalske landskaber. Tak til Willy E. Moser, til professors Thomas Fritz og David Huron, til lydguru eller lydgandalf Peter Albrechtsen, til associate professor Boris Kleber fra Center for Music in the Brain og selvfølgelig til jazzmusiker, neuroscientist og professor og leder for Center for Music in the Brain, Peter Wust. Dette afsnit af Musik i Hjernen er skrevet og tilrettelagt af mig, og jeg hedder Tim Hinman. Julia Bang snakker med Thomas Fritz og Willy E. Moser og har også været med til at producere hele serien, som er et videnskabspodcast for Third Year, støttet af Lundbeck-fonden. Og Lundbeck-fonden uddeler årligt over 500 millioner kroner til danskbaseret sundhedsvidenskabelig forskning, primært med fokus på hjernen. Musikken, du hørte i det her afsnit, var af mig og Anna Obel, som har mixet og sørget for, at det hele lyder så godt, som det gør. Jeg siger også tak til Musik i Hjernens eget orkester, som også har lavet lidt musik her, og det består af Peter Wust på kontrabas, Henrik Gunther Petersen på klaver, Hans Ulrik på saxofon, Morten Lund på trommer og Peter Dahlgren på trombone. Optaget af Frederik Nielbo. Tak til Lever Kirkegaard Blandstrup for at rette i mine manuskripter, og til Anna Tavlov for redaktionel støtte og social media. Og husk, at du kan altid lave en abonnement på 30'er på 30'er.dk, hvor du kan finde alle Third Ears podcasts.
General Keith Alexander, the director of the NSA and the commander of U.S. Cyber Command, says he thinks the biggest barrier to improving the nation's overall cyber posture boils down to a basic lack of education, both about how networks operate and the scope of the threat, as evidenced by recent episodes like cyber assaults on the U.S. financial sector and the vast destruction of data at the state-owned Saudi Aramco oil company.
I'm concerned that attacks like this are coming, and we're spending a lot of time talking about what we should do when we should do it. We ought to argue it out, just like we did in the election yesterday, come to a solution and then get going. Let's defend this. Because from my perspective, we can defend this space. We can secure it better than it is today. And we're stuck at the starting line trying to figure out how we're going to do this. And we ought to get on with it. And I believe that's going to be the push that you're going to see from the administration, from Congress, and it should be the push from business and the American people.
Alexander told Symantec's annual government symposium he thinks most of the fighting will continue to be over whether the government should be involved in setting minimum cybersecurity standards for the nation's critical infrastructure operators, something he says is needed. But there's a lot more political agreement around the notion of enabling more information sharing between government and industry and providing legal liability protections to companies who share cyber threat information and act on it.
Government cannot do what the internet service providers, the antivirus community, and the sector-specific agencies do. We need to work together. And here's part of the problem. When you see how companies are getting hit, exploited, when you look at, let's call it the first level, if you did everything perfect, you would be up to this level of security. You have all your patches in place. You've done, and you're up with either McAfee Symantec or the antivirus community. You've got everything done. You're at this level. How many companies in the United States and in our allies are at this level? We actually do inspections. We inspect our government networks to see how many are at 100%. And the answer is very few.
Alexander says there's a wide gap between companies with solid cybersecurity postures and those who may not even know that adversaries are inside their networks. He says the government can help improve those companies' security in a way he insists will still protect civil liberties by providing threat and vulnerability information gathered by the NSA. Robert Joyce is the NSA's deputy director in the Information Assurance Directorate. He says the agency has special insights into cyber vulnerabilities from inside the intelligence community, and it's already come a long way toward packaging that information in a way that can be used by the private sector. That includes best practices for hardening IT systems, developing a standard lexicon to describe threats across government and industry, and one-on-one advice to IT companies to help them make more secure products. But he says the NSA also wants to help companies incorporate what it knows about ongoing cyber threats into the day-to-day operations of private networks.
The ultimate objective is to take the classified information and share that in a way that the companies can take action to fix or prevent intrusions or vulnerabilities that maybe don't would be quickly overcome if it was widely understood. And so that's a balance point where we're trying to do that in an effective manner where the information is still viable and usable, but it's protected in that channel that we can get it out there. And there's some interesting partnerships where we're able to take information from NSA, pass it through to DHS and FBI, where they're working with critical infrastructure activities, they're working in the criminal domain, and they're able to action that activity. So a lot today of information that starts out on the intel side of NSA can wind up being actionable by companies and industry and by industry sectors where it doesn't have an NSA logo on it, but it has NSA information inside.
At the Department of Homeland Security, which serves as the primary government and industry go-between for cyber threat information, Larry Zelvin says data that originated from within the intelligence community is being shared in ways that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. Zelvin directs DHS's National Cyber and Communications Integration Center, or NCIC.
The intelligence community and law enforcement community is downgrading information in a way that I've never seen. And I've had a security clearance for 2.5 decades. So the old, you know, they overclassify it. They may, but I'm telling you, in the cyber space, things have changed. And I would like to publicly compliment all my IC partners and law enforcement partners. They get the private sector and state and locals and international need to know information, and they go out of their way to declassify an information so it can be appropriately shared. So, you know, I used to joke that, you know, when two people at an intelligence community said good morning, it was TS. No longer. They really will go to that extra mile, that extra effort, because they realize the people who need it aren't always TS or better. Now, you may not know it came from NSA or some of the other three-letter language, but it shouldn't matter. At the end of the day, what you care about the information is not necessarily who got it and how they got it.
But Zelvin says the government needs to become much more advanced in how it shares information. While cyber threats move just shy of the speed of light, warnings about them so far do not.
A lot of this is done by paper. It is done via email. It is posted on a web page. It is sometimes, I will tell you, information sharing can also happen via phone call. We should be far more advanced than we are now. As I look out at